ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नमो विष्णुपदाय कृष्णप्रस्थाय भूतले शमरिभक्तिवरान्त स्वामी नित्यनामने नमस्ते सरस्वतीदेव गौरवाणी प्रचारणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादि पाश्चात्यदेशतरणे श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव श्री गौरभक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे reading from Canto 7, Chapter 13, Verse 44.
Atmanu Bhutau.
Being situated. Translation, a learned and thoughtful person must realize that material existence is illusion. This is only possible by self-realization. A self-realized person who's actually seen the truth should retire from all material activities, being situated in self-realization. Purport, by an analytical study of the entire constitution of the body, one can surely come to the conclusion that the cell is different from all the body's material constituents, such as earth, water, fire, and air. Thus, the difference between the body and soul can be realized by a person who is thoughtful, manasi or muni. And after this realization of the individual spirit soul, one can very easily understand the supreme spirit soul. If one thus realizes that the individual soul is subordinate to the supreme spirit soul, he achieves self-realization. As explained in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there are two souls within the body. The body is called kshetra, and there are two kshetrajnyas, or occupants of the body, namely the supersoul Paramatma and the individual soul. The supersoul and the individual soul are like two birds sitting on the same tree, the material body. One bird, the individual forgetful bird, is eating the fruit of the tree, not caring for the instructions of the other bird, which is only a witness of the activities of the first bird, who is his friend. When the forgetful bird comes to understand the supreme friend who was always with him, and trying to give him guidance in different bodies, he takes shelter at the lotus feet of that supreme bird. As explained in the yoga process, when one actually becomes a perfect yogi, by meditation he can see the supreme friend and surrender unto him. This is the beginning of bhakti yoga, or actual life in Krishna consciousness. Translation, a learned and thoughtful person must realize that material existence is illusion. This is possible only by self-realization. A self-realized person who's actually seen the truth should retire from all material activities, being situated in self-realization. My previous verse talked about the offering of the different elements into its next subtle element, up to false ego, and the false ego goes into the material energy. And what happens to that material energy? Everything's up in the material energy. That gets offered into the Atma Bhuta, or self-realization. In other words, by our self-realization, our spiritual understanding, material world has no more significance anymore. So therefore, that means the material world, from the gross all the way up to the most subtle aspects of matter, they all become meaningless for the jiva if he is situated in the self. Therefore, we call it illusion. That does not mean that it does not exist. If we say it is illusion, it is very similar to Mayavad philosophy, actually. If we say it doesn't exist, illusion is something that doesn't exist. So Shankaracharya says this material world does not exist. It is not a real thing. It is like a movie which portrays actual events, but actually it's not actual events. But you get involved in it. So in the same way, the material world is like that. It's like a series of things, like a big movie, but it's actually not there. Or in comparison to our waking state, the dream state also, we say, is unreal. It isn't actually, but we think it's unreal. Because we're more attached to this type of real. So the Mayavad said this whole material world is actually unreal. The real thing is the spirit, Brahman. Everything else is unreal. However, the Vaishnavas do not accept that. We say the material world is real. Well, then why do we say it is illusion then? Why do we say it's like this, illusory or whatever? Illusory because our conception of it is wrong, that's why. It's not actually, it exists, but our conception of it is wrong. Just like you look at an object, and you may mistake one object for another. Or if we look at a mountain in the distance, it looks blue. Mountain in the distance is blue. When you get close, it's no longer blue. It's actually green. It's got some trees on it. So you can say that's some sort of illusion. From the distance it looks blue, but actually it is green. So in the same way, we were looking at this material world, we see it in one way, but actually it's not quite like that. And how do we see it? We see it as a place of enjoyment. A place where we can get objects of enjoyment and we can be happy here. This is the illusion we're in. It exists, but it doesn't exist like that, actually. It is impossible to get that enjoyment from material objects. It doesn't exist in that sense. Because it's so different from the jiva. So, material world does exist, but it doesn't exist like we think it exists, that's all. In that sense, we say it is illusory. So, one who is on the spiritual path, and he begins to absorb himself in spiritual things, then he must understand spirit soul, his eternal spiritual nature. When he does that, then he comes to this understanding that this is not quite what we think it is anymore, and he loses attachment for it. Because the soul is more real, we can say. Soul becomes the real, more real, not more real, they're both real, but he realizes the soul's real nature, so therefore it becomes more important for him. And this world becomes less important for him. Because the soul's eternal source of consciousness is actually you, and it's got nothing to do with this material world. So this material world becomes more or less insignificant. So that is the actual goal of the jiva. That's how he should progress. In the material world, things grow. They are born and they grow up and mature and then they get old and die. The good part of it is the growing up part of it. The bad part of it is the decay. Nobody likes the decay part of it. But generally we like to progress and achieve something. So physically, mentally, spiritually, that. There should be some growth in... There is in all life forms. There's some sort of progress in. And the jiva definitely goes from one body to another with the idea of getting higher and higher up. So generally that's what the Lord does to us. He puts us from lower species to higher species of life. Gradually. Step by step. So that means our consciousness gradually begins to develop. From very covered over, in which we have very little sense of anything. No movement or anything. And very little sense of awareness, maybe smell or maybe taste, touch or something. A little bit of something, but not much. And as one becomes a higher species of life, then one's senses develop to a higher degree. When we get to the higher animals, they generally have the five knowledge-gathering senses operating to some degree. This is also there in the human being. Our senses may not be as strong sometimes. We cannot smell like some animals can smell or see like other animals can see. In other words, if all our senses are operating in a passable degree of some standard is there. But what makes a human being better is that the consciousness is developed in the sense that he can be self-aware. He can understand I exist. Whereas animals cannot do that. They have feelings, etc., etc., but very little they can understand what is the future. They don't know what the future is, actually. Can't conceive of what is the future. What is life? What is death? Very difficult for them to understand. But the human being can understand, I exist, I had a beginning, I'm living now, I have a future, I have an end. So it has a self-awareness, and it's awareness of time, awareness of his body, awareness of the world. Much more, we can say, expanded awareness.
So this takes place in the human
awareness. So we gradually develop that the consciousness begins to expand. As the bodies get more suitable, then we get
higher and higher consciousness coming out. More opportunities for consciousness expressing itself. That is, the jiva can express itself more fully.
So in the human species, we have the ability on our own at that stage to do something. Animals don't have a choice. The Lord just puts them in one body after the other. In human species, that we must direct ourselves in the material world from body to body. That's our responsibility. So we start from the low and go to the high. We can do that. So it is possible for us to progress and gradually open up our consciousness. So that it doesn't operate just between body, body after body, but it operates, if we're going to progress from one body to the other, then there has to be some development of consciousness within this life. Otherwise, we're not going to get a higher life. If we remain in the same state when we die as when we're born, then we're going to be born in that same state next lifetime. So within one life, then one has to begin to develop consciousness and expand it more and more. So what is that expansion of consciousness? It can go in two directions, actually. We can expand it horizontally in one sense. And we can get aware of more things in this world. We can get more and more knowledge of things. We have more knowledge than a dog has or whatever. So this is basically what science does. It expands our awareness of this material world. So it is. We can say that's some advancement. We're very proud of that. But it's horizontal. We're using the mind on a certain level and we're increasing our knowledge of material things. But actually, the human being is meant to, because he is self-aware and he understands himself, then his real purpose is to, let's say, get knowledge of different things, higher things, not this material world. Rather than expand our knowledge of the material world, we're actually supposed to expand our knowledge upwards into higher and higher levels of existence, up until the soul. From the material level to the subtle material level to the soul. So that is what the human being is supposed to do. Get higher types of knowledge, not just more material knowledge. So this is the goal of the human being, actually. This is what he's supposed to do. It is unfortunate that the human being generally gets stuck and somehow gets absorbed in material activities, material knowledge, material enjoyment. He gets stuck on the level. So if we examine his life, he is not much better than the animal and what he accomplishes. How do we distinguish an advanced civilization, our so-called advanced civilization, from animal civilization? How would we distinguish it? We could say, well, we have built buildings, we got airplanes, we got televisions, we got movies, we got videos, we got computers. We can say that. That's how we're advanced. But then, what are all these things for, actually? What are all these buildings and computers, and what are they for, actually? And if we get down to everything, ultimately it comes back as eating, sleeping, mating, defending again. Basically, that's what it comes down to. And eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and one other thing is also there. That is recreation. Or what we call, that was that fourth area we spoke of last night. Unimportant and not urgent. Activities just to get rid of time. Time wasters. Something to occupy yourself with, amuse yourself with, but actually of not much value. This is basically what our civilization does. It invents things and like that. And it's for better comforts of the body and better food, so-called, we think it's better food anyway. And better places to live and live a healthier life with better medicines and longer lifespan and more convenience for traveling around from one place to the other, etc. All these types of things. Doing to the body. How do you do the body? So therefore, the advancements in eating, sleeping, mating, defending, recreation. This is our advancement as a human being, if you look at it scientifically. So that is not really an expansion of consciousness upward, is it? Consciousness, it's a horizontal expansion of consciousness, and just expanding your knowledge of the material world and your ability to enjoy the material world. That's all. So this is unfortunate. We get lost in this type of activity, and that tendency is always there. Generally, we see what happens. The Lord makes a Satya Yuga. Everybody's very spiritual there, and they understand their spirit, soul, etc. But as we go to Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, Kali Yuga, everyone forgets. And become gross materialists by the end of Kali Yuga. And then the Lord has to wipe everything out and start all over again. And we start with another Satya Yuga. And then material nature works its way out, and then we get covered over again, and we end up in the grass. This is the power of material nature to cover us up each time. The Lord creates a nice situation for us, and then gradually material nature covers everything up, and the jiva gets lost in the material world and falls in real maya. So it is dangerous for the living energy to stay in the material world like this, because this power of material energy is there. We think it's a power of material energy, actually. But ultimately, the source is the jiva himself and his desires. This is the problem. We can blame maya, but actually, we should not blame maya. She's only doing her function because we want that. There was a story of one rishi once. He was an odd-looking rishi. He went to Janaka's court. And Janaka recognized him as a great rishi, even though he looked very funny. So he welcomed him in the court and honored him, worshipped him, sat him down, and then he requested, "You please give us some spiritual instructions. We want some spiritual instructions." And everybody was a little doubtful. This man doesn't look like a real great saint after all. It looks so funny. And they're wondering what he's going to say. So then the king asked, "You see, I have a problem here. This material energy is so strong. How is it that this material energy attracts us so much and pulls us away? Put us in illusion. How is material energy so strong? Why is it like this? Why it bewilders us so much? And we become so attached to it. How does it? Why is it such a threatening thing that it completely grabs us and bewilders us and does everything to us?" So then the sage, he was quiet for a moment. And then he got up from his seat. And then he walked over to a pillar, and everyone was watching, "What's he doing now?" And there was a big pillar in the court, and he went over to the pillar. And then he put his arms around the pillar and held it very tight. And then he began screaming, "Let go of me! Let go of me! Let go of me!" And everyone's wondering, "What's he doing? He's not crazy." And then the sage explained, "You see, it is not that material energy is so bad after all. So don't blame material energy. Actually, we are holding on to it like this. So don't blame material energy. We're so attached to our enjoyment that we're holding on like this." And we can say, "Let go of me, material energy. Let go. We're holding on. It's our fault. It's not material energy's fault." So all of this material world is like this because of the desire of the jiva. That's all. If we don't desire, then it's not going to act like this. If we serve Krishna, then material energy acts also as a servant of Krishna and does not act as any impediment for the devotee. But as long as we don't surrender, then it acts like this. It gives two things. It gives us our enjoyment, which we want, and it also hits us at the same time. And we get stuck. We want the enjoyment, and we don't like the hitting, but still we continue to get the enjoyment. We still continue to get punished by material nature and form of karma. So it's a rather difficult situation. We can't give it up, but we don't like its situation. Where it gives karma to us, and so we're stuck. But we still can't give it up. So this is what the jiva has to battle with as a human being, and he has to make the decision whether he wants to stay like this or he wants to get out of the situation. So self-realization means we come to this level, we rise up above this level of thinking that material nature is there for our enjoyment, and we discover actually we are not bodies and we're not meant for this enjoyment at all. We're some other particle. A conscious particle is completely different from it. All this, completely different. So this is the goal of the human being. He has to raise his consciousness upwards into higher and higher realms. It is like the Bhaktivinoda describes it as the flower which is in bud. So when it's in the lower species of life, it is like this, the flower of consciousness. And when it gets to the higher species, it opens a little bit. You can see maybe the petals a little bit and the color of the petals a little bit. When it comes to the human being, it's kind of open up. And we can notice the petal color and everything like that inside, a little bit like that. But it is not completely open yet. So the purpose of human life is to make it open up fully. But it's not going to open up fully on its own. The human being has to do something at that point to make it open up. And by his activities, he has to make it open up more and more and more. And if he does other activities, it'll close up again. So if he does tamasic and rajasic activities, basically it's going to close up again and go back. And he can go to lower consciousness and he become an animal again. Or he has a choice of opening it up further and developing higher consciousness. So that is the, as I said, the generally we want to progress. And it's natural one should progress and grow and mature. Like the Bakulata bee grows, we plant the seed and it grows up naturally. So it's natural the jiva should want to progress and go from lower stage to higher stage and go higher and higher and higher until he's got some sort of perfection. Perfection or a fully manifested nature. That is the goal of the jiva. So the human being is a species where he chooses whether to go down again or up, whether to cover himself up and stop this progression, or whether to progress upward. That is what the human being has to do. So self-realization, understanding we're spirit soul, understanding God, this is the level we have to jump to as a human being. This is what we have the ability to do. This makes us special. But, as I said, our attachment to material nature is such that we get covered over and we forget very, very easily. We become very forgetful. Now, the Supreme Lord is there. Prabhupada here mentions about the Atma and the Paramatma, like two birds in the tree. So, one bird, like we have a bird in the tree, it likes to sit in a tree and make a lot of noise and eat the fruits of the tree. He likes to sit in the tree because he eats the fruits there. And he enjoys very nicely and gets absorbed in that. So that is the jiva. He's in his material body, which is like a tree, and he's enjoying everything very nicely. He's eating, sleeping, mating, depending, whatever, going about his activities, thinking this is very nice. I'm happy doing this. But of course, some of the fruit is not sweet. Some of it is bitter. It's not all sweet fruit. So then there's a mixture for that bird. Sometimes he gets happiness, sometimes he gets distressed in the material world. Not quite a perfect situation for the bird, in spite of the fact that it's he got some security in that tree. Now in that tree there's another bird. There's another bird which is similar to him and different from the tree. So there's two birds in one tree. And they're very similar. In other words, there's another Atma. There's another self, another consciousness, another conscious entity is also there. There is some difference, though, because this is the super soul, the Paramatma, so he's not exactly the same. Because this bird is not bewildered, and he's not enjoying the tree at all. He's not enjoying that fruit, so he's different. He's got more power. Not in size. The Paramatma can be smaller than the smallest and bigger than the biggest. Not the size that is important. But he is fixed, and he's not swayed by the material world or by the fruits or the tree or whatever. So he's simply sitting there in the tree. And he has the capacity to give knowledge or guidance to that other bird. Other bird is helpless. He's simply absorbed in eating the fruits. So the Paramatma has the ability to, because he's unaffected by the material world, he has the ability to give guidance to the jiva. He is the well-wisher of the jiva. He wants to do things, make sure that the jiva is doing things nicely. like a parent for the children. The parent wants to see that the child develops nicely and safe and tries to give good advice. So this is exactly what Paramatma does. That's the Supreme Lord. He tries to do this for the jiva. Give good advice. Unfortunately, the other bird is very absorbed in eating the fruit, the tree. It's looking what fruit is there in the next branch and how wonderful the color is. It must be very tasty. Huh? And how many of those fruits are there in the tree? And today I'll eat this big one, and next tomorrow I'll eat the next fruit. And very absorbed in all this. So if one is absorbed in activities, generally you don't listen to anybody else. If you're absorbed in your activities, people talk, you don't listen very much, especially if you get the enjoyment part of it. Then you're completely absorbed in that, and you don't mind what other people say. So in the same way, the jiva is completely absorbed in the material world, and the other bird is saying something, the other jiva does not listen. That bird does not listen because he's absorbed. This is better. Why should I listen to anything else? And so Paramatma tries to give advice, but jiva doesn't listen. So the Supreme Lord is always with the jiva. He never abandons him. He's always with him. But the jiva doesn't listen, and the Paramatma does not interfere. So the Paramatma actually fulfills the desires of the jiva, even though they're bad desires. If he really wants them, then he gives it to him. It's out of compassion, we can say, he gives them all these things. Oh, he wants that. It's not good for him, but anyway, we'll give it to him anyway. If he wants it like that, we'll give it to him. So whisper to the Lord. The Lord does this, but there's a stipulation, of course, because we get karma. He'll supply his karma, his desires, but there's also some reactions. He gets reactions for all this. So it's a mixed result. The Lord gives it. We say, why you should give if it's bad for the jiva? He gives it, but he gives it in such a way that he tries to teach the jiva through that by giving him karma also. He makes arrangements by which he gets a lesson through that experience of enjoyment. So that is the karma. Even then, the jiva doesn't take that lesson very well. And he still tries to enjoy in spite of that, not understanding that it's not such a good thing to do. And repeatedly he'll try to do that until he finally exhausts himself. And then maybe he'll get a little intelligence and say, no, I shouldn't do this anymore. It's very detrimental for me. I should do something else. So in other words, the jiva is a very slow learner. He's very stubborn, trying to get his material enjoyment. Doesn't change his ideas very well. And he still tries to get this enjoyment in whatever way he wants. He doesn't want to stop doing that. So the Lord tries to encourage him. In other words, he won't listen. And so the Lord gives him, but he also gives lessons to him also that he should learn. Even then, he's very stubborn, doesn't want to learn. Some jivas, fortunately, do learn. And then they turn towards the Lord. So that bird who turns towards the other bird and recognizes him, then he is situated in his glory. He becomes saved from this material condition. So this is the nature of the jiva. He's stuck in this material world and doesn't want to listen at all. And the Lord is always there trying to help, nevertheless. It doesn't interfere. It is like the story of the prodigal son. And Christ told the story, because I think it was Peter. He said, Christ went to the house of a moneylender. Moneylenders are despised because they're so materialistic. You get money and then you have to, they give money and then you have to pay interest and all this. So basically not a nice occupation, because people go there, waste their money, then they lend money and then they get caught and they borrow some money, then they have to pay the money back and they get caught in an endless circle of debts. And then the money lender runs after them, squeezes money out of them. That's not a very nice occupation. So Christ got an invitation from a money lender, and he went to his house, which is very materialistic, And I think it was Peter said, he objected. He said, how you can go to the house of this materialistic person who's so degraded? You're supposed to be spiritual and renounced, and you're going to this house like that. And then Christ gave the story of the prodigal son. Because once there was, a father. And he was a wealthy man, and he had two sons. And then he was growing old, so he was a very just father. And he decided he would divide his property among his two sons, his wealth. So he gave half his wealth to one son, half his wealth to the other son. He didn't make any discrimination. He gave equally. And he said, okay, fine. That's up to you. You're responsible for this now. So one son was very dutiful, and he didn't spend his money away. He saved it very nicely. And he took care of the father also very, very nicely with great affection. The other son disappeared. He took all his money and disappeared, went off to some other land. And they didn't hear about him for a long, long time. And the son never wrote any letters. The son never came back. The son didn't do anything. Didn't help the father. Didn't send any money. And the other son was dutifully serving the father and, you know, not wasting his money away. So that other, what happened was that other son, the prodigal son, he went away. And he had all this money and went off to the foreign land and he enjoyed like anything, spent all his money up. Completely wasted himself away, enjoyed like anything, did sinful activities, all this. Yeah. So nobody controlled, nobody did anything. The father was there in the house, the odd son was there. They didn't know where he was, he went away. Then, after all of his money was exhausted, he was suffering and suffering, and he was poverty stricken and starving and everything. Then he decided he better go back home. So he journeyed back to the same country, found the house, and he knocked on the door, and he was all poor and thin and, you know, dirty and all that, and holes in his shoes. Knocked on the door, and the father opened the door, and he saw the son, and he embraced him. And then the other son was horrified. He said, "Look, I've been serving you all these years so dutifully. You didn't do that to me. Why are you embracing this guy here? He's such a wretched guy. He just wasted all the money and ran off somewhere, didn't do anything for you." So then the father said, "Yes, he has done like that, but because he has come back, therefore I have to show him such compassion. I feel that he, you know, I feel very happy when I get my son back like this. He's been so negligent and so sinful, etc. But he's come back, so I must welcome him like this. I feel very, very, you know, great for that." So the Supreme Lord is like that. He's always wanting to help the jiva. And the jiva does so many bad things in the material world, neglects the father, neglects the paramatma's advice. The Supreme Lord is offering spiritual world. We don't want it. We come in the material world, and we enjoy like this, birth after birth. And the paramatma keeps telling us, "No, it's not right. Don't do this. Come on, get out of here." And we don't want to listen. Time after time, we don't listen to the paramatma. The paramatma's sitting there very patiently, waiting. When is the jiva going to, you know, reform himself? Huh? Of course, the Lord is very clever, and he has a material world with material bodies, and it's a condition where you get karma, etc. So hopefully through that, the jiva will realize something and eventually come back. But the Lord doesn't interfere. He supplies his enjoyment also. He also supplies him karma. But the jiva has to decide himself. So after enjoying so long in the other country, and then suffering and losing everything, then that other son, the prodigal son, he realized his mistake, and he regretted what he had done. And he wasted himself away. And then he came back and approached the father again. So in the same way, the jiva, after he's experienced so much in the material world, he may become intelligent. At that point, the Lord begins to help him and give advice to him. So that is what the Paramatma does. So there's guidance from within as the Paramatma to help the individual in his spiritual development. There's help from without in the form of devotee, sadhu, and guru to help from without also. And of course, within them also Paramatma is there helping. So therefore, basically the Lord helps externally, internally, whatever. He helps the jiva as much as he can in all situations. But it's unfortunate that we don't listen, because we're so absorbed in our material activities. The two birds are very close together. They're right next to each other, sitting in the same branch. Right next to each other. So the Paramatma is right there with the jiva. He's actually within the jiva also. And the Paramatma is everywhere, so he's within the jiva. And he's trying to remind us, but don't want to listen. So this is our great misfortune. Don't listen to the inner voice of the Supreme Lord, and instead we get absorbed in the outer world. So only after getting frustrated with our desires to enjoy and our tendency to enjoy, then we may begin to question that and give it up. Then the Lord gives us some chance at that point. We begin to listen at that point, and the Lord gives us guidance. So we have to come to this level of spiritual inquiry, spiritual quest in life. If we even begin that, it is a very, very great step. Even if we cannot perfect it in one life, if we do something, Krishna guarantees it is not lost.
So if we can begin something on the spiritual level and point ourselves in the right direction in this lifetime, that is a great accomplishment. And after many, many births, we come to this position. It is just like on a river. There are many branches and logs and things floating down the river. So the material world is an endless river. Time is flowing, and the jivas are floating down the river in their bodies like logs. And they're just floating down there, birth after birth, in an endless river in the material world, the river of time. And you can go like that forever. So somehow or other, the log comes to the shore and hits the shore and it stops. And that is the point at which it stops its material existence. We cannot predict when it's going to happen. Some logs come, some don't, like that. Jiva's like that. He's long down in the material world going like that. Maybe by good fortune of Krishna and devotees, then he can come to the shore finally. End the material existence at that point. Stop cycle of time in the material world. But it's a rare thing. We go on in the material world, body after body, covered up by ignorance. So if we get that opportunity in this lifetime, very, very great, and try to utilize it as much as we can, and try to open our consciousness as much as we can in this lifetime. Okay. Any question?
I'm sure you were talking about different levels of consciousness. And I was thinking to ask you, like in the early days, the beginning days, a lot of devotees, me and myself as well, we thought we were going to expand our consciousness before we joined the movement. LSD, you know, the director. And so when the people do that, when a lot of devotees are doing that, where were they going? What's that experience?
Oh, psychedelic drugs.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Well, all these drug things are very temporary. They have some effect on your nervous system and your brain, obviously. And they also have an effect on your subtle body, apparently. Now, the brain thing, of course, is a sudden effect, like any drug, and therefore you may experience something that looks spiritual or feels spiritual because it does something to your brain, so your perceptions get altered. So then you feel, oh, this is spiritual. The unfortunate thing is, of course, it may damage your nervous system in the process, so it doesn't function properly afterwards. That's one thing. The second thing is, usually all these drugs have very negative effects upon the subtle body, because the subtle body is very sensitive. So all the things that happen in the physical body also affect the subtle body. So a lot of things, even coffee or smoking or drinking, or meat, they have some effect. They disturb the subtle body, and they stop its operation. It gets clogged up and ruptured, and so many things happen to the subtle body because of this. It doesn't function properly anymore. In other words, mentally and intellectually, you get ruined by excessive use of drugs and things like this. It damages it. You may be able to repair it, but it takes a long time sometimes to do that repair work. So therefore, one may have a lot of problems afterwards because of that. And one may get a temporary feeling of, you know, liberation or ecstasy or whatever from the drug, but at the same time it causes a lot of damage physically and mentally, subtle, on the gross and the subtle bodies. So very not advised.
There's a lot of kids nowadays, there's so many people, they come up in the country, teenage life, and boom, it's waiting for them, that's the whole,
yeah,
everyone's hit by, you know.
Well, basically they're destroying themselves by doing that. The drugs they have nowadays are not anything to do with self-realization either. Basically, it's just enjoyment. Another type of Maya.
It's like when it changes your perception, like you said, it changes your perception. You don't actually go there in consciousness, like to a different level.
Hallucination, we can say. Of course, I think some of these hallucinogenic drugs, it is possible. Yes, it is possible you can get into other realms that way, but generally it's uncontrolled, and you may end up in the wrong realms also. And therefore you get bad experiences. You end up seeing a lot of strange things that you don't like, and you get nightmares and things like that, just like schizophrenics or whatever. They end up in these worlds also. And the worlds they see are real worlds, actually, as far as they're concerned.
and the real things there. It's just a different world, you know, and somehow their subtle body gets kind of ripped open like this, and they get into these things possess their bodies or come into their bodies, and they can see these other worlds. So basically that's what can happen with these drugs also. They can also open your subtle body up in the wrong places, and other energies can come in also. It can happen in yoga. Even yoga can do that. Yoga, they don't use drugs, but even with the yoga process, because it is dealing with the subtle body through control of the life airs, it can do things to your chakras and things. They can get opened up in the wrong way, and you can have psychic problems also, psychological problems as a result of that. Or qigong even can do the same thing. In China, they have special hospitals, psychiatric hospitals for the qigong practitioners who did the wrong thing. So many of them go off and end up crazy. They had the special hospitals for that group of people because they've been doing practices on their own and they do some wrong thing and they end up mentally unstable.
So the Hare Krishna mantra is very powerful, isn't it? To help people. You
know, yeah. But it does require that we do have that real sincerity. Huh? People that are doing other things like the drugs, basically they're not really spiritually inclined or they have no faith. They're just trying to get to some sort of enjoyment, basically. So to have real effect from them. Of course, even if we're neutral, fine, we get some effect. It's a gradual effect, but nevertheless a good effect. But if we do have faith, then it's much more powerful to help us.
Accepted using the proceeding towards pure devotion through the note of goodness, and but on another hand, statements like if devotee doesn't achieve but he continues, he goes on to the very end of his life with devotional service, that means for him. It's guaranteed that he will go back to
Krishna. Yes.
At the end of this life. How we can reconcile
that? Well, I don't think we can take a general rule for anything. It's all up to Krishna ultimately. Now, generally, of course, according to Shastra, only when you achieve prema, you're qualified for the spiritual world. And that may take many births. Like even Bharat didn't get in one lifetime from Bhava. It took him 3 births after Bhava to get to prema. Then he'd get out of the material world after 3 other births. And it took him many, many lifetimes to get out of that stage of Bhava also as Bharat. Of course, the other process is mercy. And even unqualified, you end up in spiritual world at Putana. Or the advancement of Murgari the Hunter, who very quickly, with very little sadhana, got up to Bhava within a few months. Which is usually impossible. That was also a case of mercy, kripa of Narada Muni. So in rare cases, the mercy of the Lord is there, or the mercy of the devotee is there, so that without sadhana, without the gradual work and progress, suddenly you get to a very high stage, or even get prema, and you go to the spiritual world. But that's considered very rare. In normal cases, you have to work your way up gradually through sadhana bhakti, from stage to stage. That's the normal case. The rare cases you can get out of the material like that also. So Krishna can do anything, of course, but then the normal case is through sadhana.
How we can understand, for example, we can see devotee, he stays for 20 years and he still has some real faults. He can cheat others, not even simply karmas. He can other devotees can do some.
Why does that?
And still, if he stays till the end, he goes back.
Who said? Time is not the only factor by which you go to the spiritual world. You could be in the movement for 500 years, but you may not advance because of your devious nature. That doesn't guarantee you're going to go to the spiritual world in one lifetime just because you stayed in the movement, but you did all bad activities. That's not necessary. Basically, Krishna knows what's in your heart, and it's based on that. If you're sincere, fine, you may do that. But if you have, devious nature or whatever, or duplicitous nature, we call it, duplicitous kutinati. We have the appearance of a Vaishnava, but we have so many things going on in our heart which are opposite of that. Then, how we can go to the spiritual world like that?
Right.
What is guaranteed for us?
That compared to how you can explain this verse from Bhagavad Gita, that despite some faults, if a person starting point for devotional service, we shouldn't accept him as a saint.
Yeah. This is called accidental fall down. If a devotee is a devotee and he's sincere, it is not guaranteed he's perfect because he's not on prema. So he can commit mistake, he can commit sinful activity. He can do mistakes. Bharat Maharaj made a mistake on Baba. So even on Baba level you can. Dilva Mongol Thakur also fell from his position on Baba. So even on that stage, much less to speak of lower stages, it can happen. Nevertheless, if that person has, it doesn't mean because he fell down he was sincere and he never did anything, you know, nicely. No. But it's the nature of the material world. The risk is there as long as you're in the material world and you're not on prema. It can happen. So they fall, they make a mistake, they fall down. But they didn't commit aparad, that is, committing sinful activity in the strength of the holy name. So therefore we call accidental fall down rather than premeditated fall down. I'm going to do this because I want to enjoy and I won't get any reaction because I'm a devotee and devotees don't get reactions for the sins. So therefore, I'll commit the sinful activity. That is premeditated. So therefore, it's aparad. And then your devotion decreases or may get extinguished in the process. So if you just fall because of some, you know, attraction to the material world without such a devious intention, then one still has that sincerity to serve Krishna. So then Krishna accepts that. And he doesn't mind if you've done the sinful activity. He doesn't care about that much. He sees you being devotional service. You've been doing that for a long time. So he cares about that. So he doesn't mind the sinful activity. As long as you continue your service. So the only purification for that sinful activity is to continue devotional service. That's the price. No other price that is necessary.
Yeah. Perhaps we're maybe taking some, you know, chemical substances, or might be psychological abuse or whatever. So our philosophy is that by performing bhakti yoga, this basically rectifies all the problems. But for some, it may be that their experience has been so heavy that perhaps some intermediary, maybe material, you know, some sort of counselling.
Maybe necessary in some cases.
A particular type of counselling or process that may be recommended in
intermediary
to clearing these.
Now I don't have so much experience. Maybe ask Bhakti Tirtha Swami because he was in the psychology department or something in university. He majored in psychology, I think, so he may have something in that direction. I don't know personally what's the most effective way. I think it'll vary with the individual also, whether it's counseling, hypnosis or whatever, or certain therapies, whatever. It could be so many things depending on the person.
When the body is so preaching, sometimes you encounter people the whole time that the body is preaching, especially academic people, they just try to pull apart everything that the body is saying in some of the obnoxious ways. Some people are hearing and it just makes sense to them.
That's interesting, the faith and no faith.
I say, what's the difference between the two? And how can someone who is obnoxious come to the point of submissiveness?
That's what we call the faithless person. Don't preach to the faithless person. Some feel a little hopeless. Other people are innocent. They're neutral kind of. You know, they're open, but they're not. They don't know anything. So those are the neutral people. You can preach to those people, or you can preach to the persons that have developed their faith. So it's difficult to instill faith in a person who is opposite. In other words, he's a demon, and another he's very materialistic. Very difficult to preach to them. In that case, you cannot preach. Actually, all you can do is associate with them at a little bit of a distance and try to engage them indirectly in devotional service without their knowing it. Like give them prasadam or something, or let them hear the holy name once in a while. And that's about all they can take without being offensive, you see. So if they're non-offensive and they get exposed, then that helps them a little bit. The soul gets a little affected by that each lifetime.
I had an experience yesterday in philosophy discussion class. And the subject was reincarnation, which my first thing was I wanted to, you know, dominate the conversation, but I didn't. I just let everyone discuss, mainly based on Ian Stevens'
research.
And then they come to me finally, you know, I said, well, I can speak from the Vedic perspective and explain that there were a lot more implications involved with accepting reincarnation as a fact. They all agree, yes, it's true. So there's bigger implications, now you have to analyze what you're doing, and that's going to create reaction. And that was all right, decided, well, now is a, you know, maybe it's a one-off opportunity to present Bhagavad Gita and what chapter 2 says there. So as soon as, Krishna was directly introduced, then there was like a huge division. Was the people who were curious and the people who were...
Don't bring scripture into it.
Just try to pull it all apart. even in a disguised way, there's some kind of division. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the transcendental potency of Krishna? Or is it just one?
Well, it could be due to the fact that maybe, I think the opposition is because of scripture, eh? You're quoting scripture, so they don't like scripture. They don't like anything religious. They have a prejudice against religion for some reason or other. So maybe some bad experiences of the religion or skepticism about religion itself makes them do that. I don't know. But, I don't know. It must be, they have definitely more materialistic tendencies than the other group probably.
Question again about Gyana Mishra Bhakti. You feel that you can say Gyana Mishra Bhakti is the desire.
Liberation, yeah.
Can we see the primary stages when if someone is devotee inclined, like logic or inclined to some scientific research, but he has no conscious desire for liberation.
More intellectual approach to bhakti. It is kind of Gyan Mr. Bhakti there also, and another type of Gyan, and not so impersonal, but simply an intellectual approach. Ultimately, Lord Chaitanya, Rupa Goswami says Nectar and Devotion, you cannot understand bhakti and the principles of bhakti by tarka, by argumentation and logic, ultimately. We have logical arguments, definitely logical process. You need something logical, otherwise no one's going to accept it. It was just all contradictory and everything like that. So we have a methodical process of explaining what is bhakti, etc. Huh? But the real understanding of how it works and everything cannot be, it's not just words. It's something that you have to experience. And the only way you can experience it is through the devotion itself. And so it's an outline for us, but everything cannot be explained through that. So it's basically beyond the logic. It follows a certain pattern according to, that outline, but at the same time, ultimately has to be understood not through mind, but through heart, basically. So we have tendencies, we can utilize those tendencies, definitely. Goswami, particularly Jiva Goswami, was particularly, we can say, intellectual in his approach, analytical. And Baladeva Vidyabhusan also were. They were philosophers. And most of the acharyas have that ability. Not only they have the bhakti, but they also have the philosophical and intellectual power to put things in a form which is convincing. So those are the ones that do that, and they have to analyze. It's a very complicated process. They have to analyze everything in context, follow rules of interpretation, and come up with the truth, which is according to what they believe in. And they have to defeat all of the arguments from other sides. So then, based on scriptural basis, and so it takes a lot of work and a lot of knowledge to do that, and you have to know the language, Sanskrit, and everything. So, in other words, it's very intellectual work. The acharyas usually do that. So Jiva Goswami did that, and Satsandarbha doesn't do that. Baladev did that by writing commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Ramanuja did that with his works, and Madhva also with his works. In spite of the fact that Vaishnava did very intellectual work also. So both things are there. But the intellectual work basically is not so much for our sadhana as for presenting to the outer world and convincing other people and defending ourselves against other people usually. That's why the acharyas do it. They have to defeat the other arguments with intellectual work, like philosophical arguments.
For us, sometimes it's intellectual and speculation is the same.
Not necessarily. Intellectual, of course, is the use of logic. Now, there's the rules for logic. And if you use Shastra also, then you don't have to speculate so much. Speculation means to go beyond about scripture and imagine things on your own without any reference to authorities. And if you follow authority, then the tendency to speculate will be much less.
How do you achieve everything?
Oh, well, all the spiritual processes do this, whether it's yoga or whatever, maybe karma yoga, not so much in that direction, but at least jnana and yoga and bhakti, basically, are internal processes. And of the, all those, probably yoga would be, say, the most internalized, jnana to some extent, and yoga. Well, they're both balanced because they do the external things also, but it appears that they're more internal than bhakti, because bhakti is never running around doing things all the time. It doesn't look so internal. But ultimately, bhakti is more internal because we're dealing with the very nature of, the very definition of bhakti is actually to activate the soul and to have the soul offering devotion to Krishna, which is not spoken of in yoga. Yoga, you're trying to control the mind, basically. And jnana, intellect, you're using intellect. And so bhakti, we're using the soul, and then using the mind and the body and the intellect in service of the soul to serve Krishna. Basically, it is an internal process. So how do we develop that? We do the external activities, but we do not forget the internal intentions that we have. So that way we get internal effect from it. Okay, Hare Krishna.